J.R.R. Tolkien's really famous essay called On Fairy Stories, Tolkien gave in 1939 in Scotland, later published as an essay, it's like a 60-page essay. It's like maybe the most important thing that's ever been written about fairy stories, and it was an influence on Lewis. So when Lewis wrote Narnia, he was really informed by Tolkien, so if we have time, we'll talk a little bit about that. But it's also on the sheet, so I want you to have it if you want to take it home. Then I have a sheet that talks about the sequencing of the books, because if you follow Narnia at all, you kind of know that in the 1990s, they got republished with a new ordering by HarperCollins. And some of us feel that was a little bit shady, and I'll explain why. But they were reordered according to chronological Narnia time as opposed to the original published order. And they claim that that's what Lewis wanted, but I don't feel that's really a genuine thing. I think it was more marketing driven. But in any event, we'll talk about that. And then the last page is sort of a compilation of what we call textual notes about literary allusions and references. Like someday there will be critical editions of the Narnia books with footnotes and explanations like you would get for any great literature, but it hasn't happened yet. And HarperCollins is still controlling the publishing of them. But one day it'll happen, but in the meantime, we can compile these sort of references from lots of sources, which I've done for The Silver Chair. Now, about which book to read first, if you've never read the books, raise your hand if you've never read the books. That's fine if you haven't. That's awesome because you get to read them for the first time. Father Nicholas was telling me, I think, did you read them for the first time when you were about 50? So, just a few years ago when Father Nicholas turned 50, he got to read, he was ordered, or asked to read
them. It was an assignment.
It was an assignment given to him. And so if you've never read them, let me just ask you to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first. Okay? That's really the one that should be read first. The reason I chose The Silver Chair is because I kind of suspected that most of us had read them at some point. And why not? Once you've read it through once, it's kind of like, it's not so critical what order you reread them in. But I still think the original ordering is best. And most, I guess, scholars of Lewis would agree. And that's on this handout. Should I give you the handout now? Would that just be too distracting?
Too distracting.
Too distracting?
I want to be reading.
Yeah. Okay, well, okay. If you really want one, you can come and get
them.
I'll put them right here in the Katie wants one. Well, there's plenty for everybody, but why don't I talk about a few things? So that was the first thing. So read The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe first if you haven't read them, and then read The Silver Chair. Next week I'd like to talk about The Silver Chair more like we've read it. I don't want to give away too much about it today. You know, but it's a neat story. It's less obviously allegorically Christian. So when you read The Silver Chair, there's certain Christian ideas embedded in it, but it's not quite obviously the Christian themes that you might see in the first book, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, which has a lot of parallels to New Testament events. And that's probably why The Silver Chair is interesting. But they're all interesting in different ways. So why don't I just talk a little bit about Lewis as a man, you know, his life story a little bit, and then I'll read some stuff. So he was born in 1898 in Belfast in Northern Ireland on November 29th. And he was the second son. He would have an older brother, Warren, who was about 3 years older. And they were really good friends until Warren got sent off to boarding school when Warren was 10 and Lewis is around 7. But they had a really sweet childhood. Their mother and father were good parents. Albert Lewis was a successful attorney, descended from farmers and mechanics in Wales, one of the first of his own family to complete college. He was a very eloquent man. He was known for a phenomenal memory. He would recite texts and literature that he had read. So his father had a real literary gift and also wrote. He wrote creative stories. None of them were published, but he was an aspiring writer to some degree. But he was very busy with his work. He was occupied and consumed with his work. So in the summertime, Lewis's mother would take the boys up to the coast, and the dad would always stay home because he was kind of a homebody and also was super committed to his work as an attorney. But he was also generous. He was known for doing a lot of pro bono work for people, and and he's not, by all accounts, he was a good man. Lewis said he had quite a temper, and so he said his dad has a temper, and when he has a temper, it's not so easy to be around him, but for the most part, you know, he was a pretty good father to the boys. His mother, Flora Hamilton, came from a little more aristocratic background. Her dad was an Anglican rector, and her family had ancestry with including Norman knights and stuff like that, so she had a little bit more of the high social class background. She was one of the first women to graduate from Queen's College in Belfast with a college degree. She was a mathematician. She also knew languages, so she homeschooled Lewis and taught him French and Latin herself. So she was also a creative writer, and she had a published story in a serial magazine of some kind, so she published too. So they were both big readers. They had a huge home library, and so it's no surprise that the sons both were extremely literate as they grew up. Now, Lewis's reputation as an adult was a man who was a real careful observer of things, and also was really careful about language. Right? He has a book called Study of, what's it called, Study of Words or On Words. Reading the title. He loved words.
Studies
in words. He was absolutely a word guy. And he had almost perfect recall, so you could pull a book off his shelf and start reciting a stanza from Paradise Lost or something, and he would finish it by memory. He had, like, the gift of a memory that was that good. And he was not good at math, though, so we can take comfort. He couldn't do everything well. In fact, he would not have been able to get into Oxford because he couldn't pass the math exam. But because he was a veteran of World War I, he got that exemption. He got into Oxford. So math was always kind of hard for him. He called it maths, M-A-T-H-S. So when he was about 3 years old, his mom took him to a toy store and bought him a toy train engine. And so this is a story that his mother told to the rest of the family afterwards, because the woman that worked at the toy store offered to Lewis, they called him Davey. That was his nickname at that time. Clive Staples Lewis, the two names came from the mom's side. So Baby, that was his nickname. Babs or Baby. So the woman that worked at the store offered to tie a string onto the front of the toy engine for him. And then this is what he said. Baby doesn't see any string on the engines Baby sees at the station. He didn't want a string on it. Because he observed trains. He loved trains. So Baby wasn't about having a string tied to the front. Baby. So he's talking about himself in the third person, which is kind of strange. Not long after this incident, he declared that he didn't want to be called Baby anymore. Okay. I can understand that. He marched up to his mother, pointed himself, and he declared, he is Jaxie. He is Jaxie. He wanted to be called Jaxie, so that became his name. Nobody knows why. They didn't have any, you know, Jack or John or anything. So he became Jackson, he later shortened to Jack. So all his life, his friends called him Jack Lewis. C.S. Lewis, Jack. Started when he was 3. So he was really, you know, in tune with the power of words, and he was a great observer. Now in 1905, when he was about 7, the family moved into a new house called Little Lea, L-E-A, in the suburbs of Belfast. And he said this house almost became a major character in his childhood, because it was so remarkable in terms of the long corridors, empty sunlit rooms, attics that you could explore in solitude. There was even a wooden wardrobe that his dad had built that sometimes they'd hang out in, and he'd tell stories to his cousins and so on. So it's got all the furniture of this big house that you could imagine reading about, like in a line was in the wardrobe, which probably has a lot to do with that. So he and Warren then hung out together, and they played a lot, and there was a big concern for their health. I think, was it tuberculosis that was a real concern at that time in Ireland? So the parents were super scared about them going out when it was rainy or wet. Like, if it's threatening to rain, the first drop, they had to run inside, and they'd have to be inside until it was totally dry. So they spent a lot of time indoors reading. And there's just tons of books, a lot of kids' books and a lot of adults' books, he said. They read it all. And so they read a ton, and they also started to create their own world. So Warren had an imaginary world that he called India, and Lewis's was called Animal Land. He had a lot of characters, like animals who would dress up with clothes. And so they had these imaginary stories they would tell, a lot of political and parliamentary kind of intrigues and stuff. And then eventually they combined that into an imaginary land called Boxen.
B-O-X-E-N. And so they had their own shared, like as siblings, they had this fantasy land that they would tell stories about.
And they would talk about their whole lives.
So a lot of the origins, you can see that Lewis is an imaginative writer, comes from that childhood fascination where he would read stories by Edith Nesbit and Beatrix Potter. So he read tons of children's stories that he loved, and he picked up a lot of imagery and character types, you know, from the stuff that he had read even then. So he recalled his childhood as a time of loving parents, good food, plenty of room for play outdoors when it was not raining, and a beloved nurse. So not only had they had a governess that helped homeschool him as well, and then they had a nurse who he loved, Lizzie Endicott, and she would tell them, the brothers, these wonderful Irish folk stories, and she was like a great person, the epitome of goodness. And so for Lewis's entire life, whenever he uses the word nurse or nursery, it's such a positive thing. Same with childhood and child, even childlike, for Lewis is the epitome of his innocence and self-forgetfulness and goodness. It's all about this like really sweet childhood he had. So Lizzie Endicott entertained them with these stories of leprechauns and voyages to mystic isles and things like that. If you know the Chronicles, there's in Prince Caspian, there's this great nurse that is telling the old Narnian stories to one of the characters, and she ends up getting fired basically because the bad king, you know, realizes that she's undercutting his sort of approach to the education of this prince. So that nurse is like a really good image for Lewis. All right, so they would go to the summer holiday by the sea. There was this castle up there called Dunluce, and Lewis drew a really nice hand sketch of that castle when he was a kid. And it's sort of like you'll see a castle, you know, in Narnia, the Caer Paravel, this imaginary castle on the water and all that. So he saw images when he was young that were really important to give him some ideas for his stories later. He had several what he would call spiritual experiences as a child. He was kind of ostensibly in a Christian household, but his spiritual experiences weren't in church. They were a little more mysterious, if you will, mystical maybe. He called them pure and momentous experiences, and he called them an experience of what he called joy with a capital J, or longing with a big L. His experiences of joy or longing, he had several of these as a very young person, kind of were really formative for his, not only his imagination, but his feeling that there was something enchanted almost about the world that we live in, it made him want to yearn for something that he couldn't quite find. Now there's a German word for this that starts with an S. I don't really know how to say it. Sehnsucht, something like that.
Sehnsucht.
Sehnsucht. Thank you, Paul. So I guess it's a technical term that German speakers know about, but this is this longing. He described it as a longing for a lost paradise. That is a kind of paradise just to feel. It's a fleeting and a momentary thing. But it drew him to believing that there was something beyond this world that he was being led toward. When he was six years old, he had a memory of an earlier experience when his brother Warren made a miniature garden on a biscuit tin and had twigs and moss on it. And he had a memory of that, and it was so beautiful. He compared it to Milton's comment of the enormous bliss of Eden. So this memory of this toy garden evoked in him some really deep yearning. And then later he was looking at a picture of the autumn leaves in Beatrix Potter's book called Squirrel Nutkin. And the picture of those autumn leaves stirred in him this real mysterious longing for something. He went outside, he wanted to go see the autumn leaves, and he did. But then he looked at the autumn leaves, and he was yearning to see the picture in the book. So he went back and looked at the picture in the book. But nothing quite satisfied what he was yearning for. But he had that fleeting experience. And then he was reading a poem by Longfellow. I mean, he was reading Longfellow, right? As a 7-8-year-old. And Longfellow had a poem which was translating some Nordic myths. So he would end up becoming a lover of the mythology of the Northlands, right? In Northern Europe. And there was a line that said, I heard the voice that cried. I heard the voice that cried, Balder the Beautiful is dead. And he said when he heard that, he was lifted into huge regions of northern sky. There was something in that verse
about the death of this god. Balder was the god of beauty, goodness, and wisdom in Norse mythology. And he was killed by a mistletoe dart from his blind brother. And that killed him. And then when that god died, it really had a bad effect on all of the gods in the Norse pantheon, apparently. So here he is being stirred in a real deep way that he doesn't quite understand by nature, by pictures, by poetry, and then just the horizon itself. He would look from, so they were in the suburbs of Belfast, and they would look out, and there are these hills, and he'd never, like, just yearn to go there, and he never could or would, but he could see those hills in the distance. So he had this experience of longing, which is really important to him. When he came to writing his Narnia stories as a much older man, he was trying to tap into that experience and maybe give his readers something similar. But his great childhood came to an abrupt end when he was just 9 years old. So it was so sweet in a way, but it just crashed down because his mother got cancer and died within 6 months. And he was just nine. It was 1908. He was only 46. And basically, within a few weeks, he was sent off to boarding school near London, to a terrible school. And it was a school where Warren had already gone. So Warren was there, at least for a while. But he basically lost his father and mother within a matter of a few weeks, and his home. He was an orphan. He described himself as an orphan from then on. And it was terribly vexing because the school, the headmaster, was certified as insane, and the school was closed down. He was brutal. And one theory about why Lewis was bad at math is because in these schools, if you weren't getting your math problems correctly done, you could be punished. But he spent a couple of years in that school outside of London. It was a wretched place. He later, in his autobiography called Surprised by Joy, he called it Belsen, after the German prison camp from World War II. Okay, so retroactively kind of evaluating it. So it was terrible. He did, though, go to some Anglican church services, which were required by this headmaster. But he felt trapped in a religion of guilt, not grace. He came to associate Christianity with the condemnation of other people who didn't believe what you believed. And it's partly the Northern Ireland troubles that I think set up that paradigm too. His father was a little more vehement. His mother was a little more irenic. In other words, she was more into cooperating between... They were both Protestant, but the mom was a little more into cooperating with the Roman Catholics. But as Lewis went into this phase of 6 or 8 years in these schools, in his so-called orphanage period, he started to find Christianity distasteful because, number one, he was kind of left wanting. He felt let down because people, I think, mistakenly, clearly told him that when his mom was sick, if he only had enough faith, he could pray and she'd live. You know, that theology was laid on him as a child. Just pray more, have more faith, she'll make it. And then as a young man, you know, he had tutors and teachers that were not Christian and were trying to lure him to things like occultic things and different practices that he didn't really ever go too deeply in. But there were people that were sort of pulling him off the path a little bit. But generally speaking, he was taught that Christianity was true and therefore everything else was 100% false. If you ever read his, like, Mere Christianity, one thing that's really important for him as a Christian to realize is just because I believe I found something that's true, it doesn't mean that everything else is 100% wrong. This is where Christianity differs from whatever, Confucianism. I guess I could say that Christianity might be right and Confucianism might be wrong on that point. But it's not like everything else is 100% wrong. But he was taught that. So he was rejecting a Christianity that was portrayed as the only thing, everything else, nothing true about it. He didn't feel that was fair. And he also felt like he couldn't live up to God's standards. So he was kind of, it wasn't sustainable. And he ended up leaving it behind and becoming kind of an atheist, really. So he left his childhood faith behind. He spent 2.5 great years with a tutor called William Kirkpatrick from 1914 to 17. So when he was about 16, I guess, he was finally hooked up with this tutor, who was a brilliant man. He lived with the tutor and his wife. And he was a great magician. super smart. And the character Professor Diggory Kirk in the books, that's modeled after William Kirkpatrick. But the problem with they call him the Great Knock. He was a great personality, but he was a super hardcore atheist. And so he had this real brilliant mind, and he was teaching Lewis a super materialist view of life, where the only thing real was what you could perceive with your senses, and it was a real serious philosophy that excluded the supernatural. So that wasn't so great for Lewis, but it helped him to think really well. So when later he gets a first degree in philosophy from Oxford, it has a lot to do with how well he was taught by the Great Knock. But the interesting part was during this period of super rational intellectual development with Kirk, from 1914 to 17, it's a real idyllic time. He was studying real hard. Like, we could probably not even relate to the amount that he read and how much he learned and memorized. It was just stunning. But he had the capacity for it. He was really gifted with language in particular. But he also read some stuff in his free time that really fueled his imagination and tapped into those earlier sort of mystical experiences. One was Edmund Spenser's poem called The Fairy Queen, which is a medieval poem that's a lot like what Narnia amounts to, adventures in fairyland, so to speak, with evil enchantresses and quests and characters who are risking a lot. So he loved Spenser's Fairy Queen. It kind of shaped his ideas about fairy stories and ends up influencing Narnia. And he would end up becoming a scholar of medieval and Renaissance literature. So this is absolutely up his alley. He also read George MacDonald, the Scottish preacher and fantasy writer. You think that Lewis has written one. I mean, Lewis wrote 40-plus books, right, in his lifetime. George MacDonald makes Lewis look like a slacker. He wrote so much. He was so prolific. Crazy. But he wrote fantasy books, and one was called Fantasties. It was published in 1858, and when Lewis read that in 1916, he called it a watershed experience. Now, this is like an episodic, sort of dreamlike story about a male character, a young protagonist whose mother died in his childhood. He travels to an enchanted wood, and he escapes this kind of temptress, like a white witch figure that you might see in Narnia. And in any event, it had this experience on Lewis. He called it a spiritual healing. He had the sense of being washed. And later he said his imagination was baptized by George MacDonald. He was a preacher, a poet, and a fantasy writer. So he has a lot in common with Lewis. Over the years, Lewis refers to George MacDonald so much. He just respected him like as an older, as like a mentor figure. All right, so he said the bright shadow of holiness was sort of coming out of his experience of reading this book, even though, logically or rationally speaking, he didn't believe that there was anything, you know, other than the material world because of how he was being taught to be a materialist. What he said later about MacDonald, though, he said, quote, "The quality which enchanted me in his imaginative works turned out to be the quality of the real universe, the divine, magical, terrifying, and ecstatic reality in which we all live." So I think that one of Lewis's big themes is that we do live in an enchanted world. Our world is enchanted, and it's only because there's been like a spell of worldliness cast upon us by our education and just by the cultural mindset that we've adopted in modern industrial life and so on. We don't see its enchantment the way we might. So Lewis really felt that these stories were going to help us understand the depth and the mystery of the world we actually live in. Okay, so he gets accepted into Oxford, a really good. I don't know how he did that. The timing of the math test I'm not totally clear on, but I'll have to just skip that. But he gets accepted to Oxford, but then he gets called into World War I. He gets called into service. So he spent 2 years as a soldier in the British Army. And he arrived at the front lines on his 19th birthday on November 29th, 1917. So he fought in World War I. He, first of all, he caught trench fever. He spent a month in a French hospital. And he went back to the lines, and then he was wounded when a shell exploded right next to him. And he had 3 wounds, and he was evacuated to France and later back to England. So I don't know how long he was on the front, but it was long enough to get injured by this explosion. And he spent months and months convalescing in England, and one really sad thing is that he couldn't convince his father to come down from Belfast to visit him. His father never came to see him. And that was kind of, they had an estrangement. See, like, his father didn't tell you this, but when mom died, his father
really couldn't hold it together. He was kind of an emotional guy, and it was just so much, and he just sort of lost it. Whether it was his temper or his ability to deal with his own kids, and the whole family felt like really fractured in terms of the relationship with the father. And then this thing later that happens much later in 1917, 18, that kind of was a final wedge for Lewis and his dad. Really sad. Yeah, it wouldn't come. But strangely, he lost his father, but he kind of gained a surrogate mother because he had a good friend named Patty Moore, and they were friends for months, and they were both soldiers. And they promised each other, they said, if one of us dies, the other of us has to take care of our parent, because they each had one parent left, Mrs. Moore and Mr. Lewis. So Patty Moore ends up dying. So Lewis finds out that his friend was missing and wasn't coming back. So he tells Mrs. Moore and his like 12-year-old daughter that he's going to take care of her and them. And so sure enough, when he gets out of the hospital, he re-enrolls at Oxford, and the three of them move in together. And Lewis becomes like her son almost, and she'll live with him for 30 years, and he will take care of Mrs. Moore. And she wasn't easy to live with at all, from what you read. She was a handful, but Lewis honored that promise to his friend. And so eventually, when they moved to what's called the Kilns, which is like a miniature Little Lee, the famous house he lived in Oxford, and Warren came, when Warren got, he was in the Navy, I think, and he got out of the service, he came and lived with them. So Lewis and his brother lived with Mrs. Moore, and I think the daughter had moved out after a while. So early on, he was trying to publish poems. He wanted to be a poet. So about the first 30 years of his life. So he lived till 1963. So he died when he was 64. He was a year short of his 65th birthday. So about the first half of his life, Lewis published two tiny books of poetry that went out of print almost immediately. And they're kind of dark. They're really intricate, metrically, like super crafted well, but he was not yet reconverted. So his reconversion is looming.
Are you doing on time?
Plenty of time.
Oh no!
Yeah,
we started.
I can't come next week.
We started 5 minutes late, so maybe I'll like get an extra 5 minutes.
Okay, so so he gets a first degree. He got what's called a triple first, like a triple major at Oxford. He's one of a couple people in the 20th century that actually could do this. I mean, this is crazy what he did. Classics in 1920, ancient philosophy in 1922, and English literature in 1923. And he was asked to work for a one-year kind of temporary tutorship or something. He did that, and then he was elected to become a fellow at Magdalen College, which he did for about 30 years. So he worked at Oxford for 30 years before, at the end of his life, he went to Cambridge and finished up his career there. So Lewis at this time, because he studied philosophy so carefully, he was nudged from his adolescent atheism into an interest in what they call idealism. So philosophical idealism holds that there's some kind of absolute or life force that's in the background. It's sort of a nebulous, but you know, a possibly supernatural force that could be behind the appearances of what we see. And he was drawn towards that, but his question was, but did this life force have a mind? Does it have a mind, or is it just some vague, energy? And so he was grappling with that. By his late 20s in Oxford, he began to sense that he was grappling with something or even someone concrete and personal. So he was moving towards a belief in God, and it was the summer of 1929, so he was 30, that he converted to theism. So he started to believe in a personal God, but he wasn't quite sure how to define that. So it wasn't quite Christian yet, it wasn't Trinitarian. But he converted to theism. At the time, he was riding on one of those double-decker buses, and he said he just felt like he was being presented with a choice. It was like a door was in front of him. He could open a door, or he could bolt it shut. It was up to him. And he said, and he used some other analogies. It's kind of hard to portray. It's kind of a, you know, mysterious thing. But he decided to open it. And so he started to believe in God, and he met people like the Christians J.R.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson, some of these
other fellows that taught at Oxford, and they become, so he's getting Christian friends, and he started reading more Christian writers, or being attracted to people like G.K. Chesterton or Samuel Johnson. And it was a couple of years later, in the fall of 1931, where Lewis had his, what he called his reconversion to Christianity. It was a major change in his thinking. And it sort of stemmed from a conversation that he had with Tolkien and Dyson when they were walking behind Magdalen College. It looks like Magdalen, Mary Magdalen, but they pronounce it Magdalen. So he was on a walk in the forest behind Magdalen College with his friends. And he had read comparative religion books as a younger person, a famous book called The Golden Bow by James Frazer. And in that book, Lewis had remembered reading about the myth of the dying god, the god who dies, like Balder the Beautiful, the dying god in many, many cultures over many different times. And Lewis, probably under the influence of Kirk, said, see, Christianity can't be true. What's so special about that? All these other mythologies have a dying god. I mean, what? It's just another version of that. So for Lewis, that was an argument against the truth of Christ as a young man. He concluded that there was nothing particular or unique about Christian narrative of God who came to earth and died and rose again. But here's what Tolkien said. And this is a really big moment. He said, hey, all those dying God myths kind of show us this universal intuition that we can't save ourselves as human beings. We need help. There's a God that comes and dies and comes to life to help us kind of get someplace that we can't get on our own. We need redemption as a gift from a God who can do that. And Tolkien further said that Christ's incarnation was the historical embodiment of the dying God myth. And Lewis would later say he came to realize that the story of Jesus Christ was a myth that became fact. It was a historical fact, but it was still a myth. And it was important for him, because myths for him, this is a very positive word for Lewis. It's an enchanted sort of story. And so it was a true myth. So Tolkien convinced him that Jesus Christ was the true historical embodiment of all those cultural stories of a dying God that comes to life. The difference is that it really happened. So what this did for Lewis was it somehow gave him a bridge between his intellect and his imagination, between his love of fantasy or fairy story or mythology, Norse stories, and his rigorous sort of logical intellect. And so all of a sudden his imagination and intellect could start to grow in complementary, not competitive ways. So there was a sense of recovery for Lewis, or being able to re-embrace these different parts of him, these sort of disparate parts of his personality. Lewis once said, earlier in his life, when he was grappling with his love for the Fantasties and the Fairy Queen, but also trying to hold on to a strict materialist philosophy, he said that nearly all that I loved, I believed to be imaginary, and nearly all that I thought to be real, I thought grim and meaningless. But this whole encounter with Tolkien and Dyson gave him a way to somehow reconcile the intellect and the imagination. The true myth. So he later came to believe that our imagination is what he called the organ of meaning, in which we have pictures and metaphors and myths by which we understand the world, and then we combine that with our intellect. He calls that the organ of truth, which weighs, sifts, and analyzes and sort of discerns which products of the imagination are most closely corresponding with reality. So that was his reconversion. It actually happened again while he was traveling on the road. He was actually in the sidecar of Warren's motorcycle. You don't see those very often, but those little, you know. So he never learned how to drive, you know, Lewis, but his brother did. And so he was in that sidecar, that motorcycle, and by the time he got to where they were going, I think it was the zoo, he said he realized he committed his life to Christ. And he did believe in him.
In a sidecar?
Yeah, in a sidecar. Kind of funny. So So the second half of his life then, that really began with that reconversion, he would write 40 plus books, and he would write literary and scholarly books, Christian apologetics like Mere Christianity or The Problem of Pain, and then speculative fictional books like Narnia and space
trilogy, and so on. So he lived at the Kilns really his whole life, where he had moved in 1930 with Mrs. Moore. She finally died in 1951. He became really popular during and after World War II because he had traveled around the Royal Air Force and asked him to give lectures on the weekends. So he'd go talk to soldiers, and then his radio broadcasts were on the BBC. And of course, that became Near Christianity later. So he's getting popular, but he hadn't really started Narnia until he was about 50 years old. And it's kind of neat. It's like he never had children. He married much later in life and got a couple of stepsons, but he didn't have children of his own. And we're not sure exactly why he started writing the Narnia books, but he did. He explained that he wrote them because he had all these pictures in his mind, and they were demanding that he do something with them as an artist. He said that he needed a form. He had a picture of a fawn carrying an umbrella or parcels and a lion. He had dreams about lions. He was really visual. And so he said the way he wrote books was more like bird watching than like sitting down and intellectually coming up with a story. So he could collect these images, like bird watching, I guess, and then try to find a way to put those into a story. So he ended up writing The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, and for those of you who are going to read it for the first time, you'll note from the very beginning that it's about a few children that move out of London into the house of this professor because it's World War II and the bombing raids are happening in London. And so that actually happened because Lewis did have kids come out with the Kilns during World War II. And so it was a delightful experience. He loved the young people. They were really sweet and he got along with them well. And so he uses that plot to get the whole thing started. But he wrote all seven of the Narnia Chronicles in about 4 years, from 1948 to 52. And he'd already written a lot of scholarly books and some Christian books. So he was kind of already out of the closet as a Christian in Oxford, which was kind of costly because a lot of people didn't like that. The intellectuals weren't really big on that. You don't do that, you know. And he still is considered one of the foremost scholars of medieval and Renaissance literature. I mean, wow, he is legit as a scholar. And so he had this really serious scholarly reputation, but he wasn't afraid to write Christian apologetics or the Screwtape Letters or the space fiction, which we won't talk about so much in here, but, you know, planetary romances. So he was starting to do that stuff, but the Narnia came along even later, and a lot of people weren't big fans of it. It's like, Lewis, what are you doing? You know, you know, don't do this. That's below you. You know? But one thing that he said, which was just indicative of both Tolkien and Lewis, is that, hey, you know, these fairy stories aren't just for children. And that his big argument is that it's not a child genre. It's for everybody. So let's see if I can find that quote. Yeah, did I put in the bulletin this week? Yeah, it is in the bulletin. Do you have a bulletin? I'll go find it quicker there. So on the handouts, I'm gonna have an explanation of why Lewis and Tolkien felt that these are not just children, that children can enjoy them, because children are a different creature. They're just a less mature human being. So it's not like children are so fundamentally different than anybody else. He says not all children like fairy stories, and not all adults like them. But adults can like them just as much. And he and Tolkien did. So he said, when I was 10, Lewis said, I read fairy tales in secret, and I would have been ashamed if I had been found doing so. Now that I'm 50, I read them openly. When I became a man, I put away childish things, including the fear of childishness and the desire to be very grown up. So it's okay for us to read them and delight in them. And then, Connie, I think you told me that probably the last books that Father David read were the Seven Chronicles of Narnia, reread, right? He had that big book of all seven of them.
He said he couldn't concentrate on anything else anymore, but he could go out and get the Chronicles of Narnia and get into Anne.
Wow.
A month before that.
Isn't that sweet? What better thing to read, really? So, okay, so get the handouts, and how are you doing on time?
Plenty of time.
Okay. I just want to respect everybody. I don't want to be all going home over too late. But okay. So we go like notify with them. if that's
okay.
Do you
have more handouts out there?
There should be more handouts.
We're forcing you.
Okay. People can leave if they have to at any time. Good. Here's a few more handouts.
So one thing that we should say is that Lewis didn't write these as a puzzle that we're supposed to decode and find all the Christian stuff, like it's a Where's Waldo game or something like that. That's not at all what he was doing. So there's some allegorical elements, but he didn't write them as allegory where he tried to put in Christian themes for us to figure out. Here's what he said in an essay himself called Sometimes Fairy Stories May Say Best What's to Be Said. He says, some people think I began to ask myself how I could say something about Christianity to children, then fixed on the fairy tale as an instrument, then collected information about child psychology, and decided what age group I'd write for, then drew up a list of basic Christian truths, and hammered out allegories to embody them. This is all pure moonshine. I could not write that way at all. Everything began with images, a fawn carrying an umbrella, a queen on a sledge, a magnificent lion. At first, there wasn't anything Christian about them. That element pushed itself in of its own accord. It was part of the bubbling. Then came the form. All these images sorted themselves out into events, and they seemed to demand no love interest and no close psychology. But the form which excludes these is the fairy tale. And the moment I thought of that, I fell in love with the form, its brevity, its severe restraints on description, its flexible traditionalism. I was enamored of it. Its very limitations of vocabulary became an attraction. By the way, so he writes with a limited vocabulary, but still a lot of words that we don't normally use. So that's partly why I did that third page, which translates some of the slightly less common words. So he's not writing allegory, and he doesn't want us constantly to be trying to decipher. He wants us to just read the story and have an experience, right? And if we notice biblical allusions, okay, that's fine. But here's what he wrote to a class of fifth graders in 1954. It's probably in America. Oh, yeah, it was in Maryland. So a class in Maryland wrote to Lewis. And he said, "Dear fifth graders, I'm so glad you like the Narnian books, and it was very kind of you to write and tell me. There are to be 7 of them altogether, and you are already 1 behind. Number 4, the silver chair, is already out. You are mistaken when you think that everything in the books represents something in this world. Things do that in The Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan. But I'm not writing in that way. I did not say to myself, let us represent Jesus as he really is in our world by a lion in Narnia. Rather, I said, let us suppose that there were a land like Narnia, and that the Son of God, as he became a man in our world, became a lion there. Then imagine what would happen. If you think about it, you will see that it is quite a different thing." And then they ask him what he looked like. So he said, "I'm tall, fat, rather bald, red-faced, double chin, black hair, have a deep voice, and wear glasses for reading." And then he says, "The only way for us to get into Aslan's country is through death, as far as I know. Perhaps some very good people get just a tiny glimpse before then. Best love to you all. When you say your prayers, sometimes ask God to bless me. Yours ever, C.S. Lewis." That's sweet. So this is a whole book called Letters to Children. It's just the most touching book because he takes children very seriously. He really does. And he gives them advice about writing, and he reads their stuff and gives them comments. They'll send them poems and stories. And to one writer, he says, "I don't think age matters so much as people think. Parts of me are still 12, and I think other parts of me were already 50 when I was 12. So I don't feel very odd that they grow up in Narnia while they are children in England." Because, as we know, most of us, that Narnia, this imaginary country, when the children transition into Narnia, they're sort of like into a new time sequence. So they might spend many years in Narnia and come back out, and it's only been 10 minutes in England. So there's these two different parallel universes with different time structure. Maybe I'll just call attention to a few things on the handout before we wrap it up. So the first one is really about the fairy story and how they connect to that sense of joy or longing. And he says that despite the dangers and discomforts that we get in a fairy story, because there's traps and tricks and evil sorcerers and some serious bad characters, he says, they still arouse in us a deep longing for we know not what, for something beyond our reach. So this is the central theme. And I think this is kind of interesting as Orthodox Christians too. Here Lewis warns us not to confuse superficially realistic and quote-unquote dangerous, he calls fantasy, books about millionaires, posh hotels, and bedroom scenes, with a healthier kind of ineffable longing that is sometimes mediated through good literature. Listen to what he says. For as I say, there are two kinds of longing. The one is an ascesis, a spiritual exercise, and the other is a disease. So he's talking about, he's not talking about fantasies in the sense of passions or thoughts that are taking us out away from reality, but ones that are drawing us out of this world to the uncreated life of God. So, then after that I just give you a breakdown of Tolkien's essay, more or less. What are fairy stories? Are they just for children? No. And then on the back of that, this is kind of neat, and this is something we'll have to just read if you're interested. But to the question to Tolkien, like, what's the use of fairy stories? He said, well, let me answer it by giving you the four values and functions. He calls them values and functions of fairy stories. And he says, if anything, older people need these more than children. Number one, fantasy. Fantasy is a trip to what he calls a secondary world that has been created well by a writer. And when we enter Narnia or Middle Earth or wherever you go, if it's created well, Tolkien says we have the experience of literary belief. It's believable while we're there. And notice they don't call the real world, our ordinary world. They call this the primary world and what they create, the secondary world. So that's a wonderful thing. And Tolkien says this: the beautiful quality of strangeness and wonder of fantasy is not well suited for drama or visual depiction. So moviegoers, this could be kind of a blow if you like the film, because I think Tolkien would have been horrified at the idea of putting a visual depiction to any of his books, let alone Lewis. Drama is naturally hostile to fantasy, he writes, and fantastic forms are counterfeited when visibly and audibly acted. For example, talking animals tend toward buffoonery, falling short of true fantasy. The problem comes when the imaginary is actually beheld, which is a sort of counterfeit magic. So much for these guys was about the words creating this imagery in our minds apart from direct visual representation. Second thing was escape. He says, reading fantasy stories is not escapist in a negative way. Like, oh, you're just reading that because you can't cope with reality. Escape. It's like, well, think about it this way. Escape is heroic, not cowardly. Why should a man be scorned if he's in prison? He tries to get out of prison and go home. He says his sense of imprisonment in the modern industrial age, where ingenuity and ugliness have often combined to offer inferior results and disturbing effects. So not only is our daily life kind of... He didn't like the internal combustion engine. He and Lewis didn't even like zippers for their pants. They thought they were too modern.
Books are not.
Isn't that crazy? But no, he really felt like modern industrial life was making our lives uglier. But he says there are other things more profound that we might escape, more grim and terrible than the stench of the internal combustion engine. He said hunger, thirst, poverty, pain, sorrow, injustice. There are also ancient limitations that prevent us from satisfying our primordial human desires, like flying or conversing with animals. He said that's a desire as ancient as the fall. We want to talk with animals, but we can't. Or visiting the deep sea. And the great oldest escape, he says, the great escape is the escape from death. He's like, why call someone an escapist or a coward if they're trying to escape from this world of pain and suffering and death towards a world of life and goodness? So that's the world that Lewis had as a child, you know, that goodness of life. And he's trying to show us that in Narnia. Okay. Finally, recovery. So, interestingly, you could go into a secondary world and you could recover a clear view of life even in the primary world. So you can bring back from Narnia or Middle Earth a better understanding of creation. Lewis and Tolkien both agree. Lewis would often recommend this essay to people when he wrote letters. He would say, you got to check this out. Probably the best thing written. It is true that Tolkien didn't like Lewis's stories as much as Lewis liked Tolkien's stories.
No.
Tolkien wasn't really a fan. And we could talk more about that. But it has something to do...
So when you create a secondary world, you've got to stay in that secondary world for that literary belief to really work. You can't be coming in and out and break the spell. Tolkien said that's why he never put any like things that called people's attention to life in our primary world. Lewis, on the other hand, will use classical mythological references. He'll talk about trains and cars and mailboxes or lampposts, things that kind of pull us back to our world. Because for Lewis, he thought that the primary and the secondary worlds could interpenetrate. He thought that they could be interdependent, that kind of mysterious, mystical fantasy world could kind of merge with everyday life. Tolkien had a little more clear separation. He thought Lewis was just being sloppy. And he might have been jealous, too, because Lewis wrote them so quickly. And Tolkien wrote, you know, for years and years. But they're different. But it's true that they were best friends in the 1930s and 40s, and less so towards the end of Lewis's life. And partly because Tolkien was Roman Catholic, and he never got Lewis to convert. I think that might have been part of it. And I don't think Tolkien approved of Lewis's choice to marry Joy Davidman, who was an American woman who was divorced. So there were different things that estranged their friendship, but they had a real common love of fairy story, although they wrote it in slightly different ways with respect to the relationship between the primary and the secondary world. Finally, the last thing, consolation. So a fairy story has sort of like a happy ending, but not exactly, because they really have no true end. Tolkien says, consolation is a joyous turn produced by a sudden miraculous grace. While a tragedy ends in catastrophe, fairy stories end with what he called eucatastrophe, E-U, a good catastrophe. So he coined that term. It's pretty cool. A eucatastrophe is a good catastrophe that somehow brings a sudden turn of grace. Maybe someone comes back to life, or who knows? We'll have to read the stories to see how Lewis has eucatastrophic events of his own, like in The Silver Chair. There's a real clear eucatastrophe. Tolkien says, eucatastrophe doesn't deny the existence of sorrow or failure or even death, but it does deny universal defeat. It leaves us with hope, giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, a joy beyond the walls of this world. So you can see how both Lewis and Tolkien, in their Christian views, thought their literature could kind of help us get out of this world and long for something more, something eternal. Really, this desire for paradise. Maybe that's a good time to stop.
Thank you.
Hey, all right. So do you want to read The Silver Chair for next week? Can you do it? And we have some for sale down the bookstore if you need one. And if you haven't read any of them, you've got to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first. That's your assignment. All right. Same one as you.
Oh.
Yeah. I was reading the back of the one with the four bodies.
That's great.